Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. My name is Pavi, and I will be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome and thank you for joining us. The purpose of these calls is really to share stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us through their actions to live in a more service-oriented way. Behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. Today, our guest is none other than Frank Ostaszewski, and someone who really embodies today's theme of what the living can learn from the dying. Thank you again for joining today's call. Let's start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves. Thank you, and welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call. Today, in conversation with Frank Ostaszewski. Here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Emmanuel Joseph, will engage in deep dialogue with our guest, and by the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A and a circle of sharing, where we invite all your reflections and questions. I've opened up the queue right now, so at any point, you can hit *6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. I'd like to take a moment to introduce our very special moderator for today's call, Emmanuel Joseph. Emmanuel Joseph is the CEO and founder of Culture of Kindness, an app that looks to spread compassion in the workplace and in schools. He is a former cancer scientist, a writer, a published author, and a volunteer for Daily Good. He's also a life coach, and it is an honor to have him with us today. Thank you, Emmanuel, for your service in so many areas of life. I will hand over to you now for an introduction of Frank and to set the ball rolling.
Thank you, Bobby. Frank, it's a pleasure to have you here today.
Oh, I'm very, very delighted to be with you.
Oh, thank you. So, Frank Ostaszewski is a Buddhist teacher and a leading voice in contemplative end-of-life care. In 1987, he co-founded the Zen Hospice Project, the first Buddhist hospice in America. In 2004, he created the Mehta Institute to provide innovative educational programs and professional trainings that foster compassionate, mindfulness-based care. A primary project of the Mehta Institute is end-of-life practitioner program that Frank leads with faculty members Ram Dass, Rachel, Naomi, Raymond, and others. Frank is a dynamic, original, and visionary teacher. His public programs throughout the United States and Europe have introduced thousands to the practice of mindful and compassionate care of the dying. In 2001, Frank was honored by His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, for his years of service to the dying and their families. In 2003, he was named one of America's 50 most innovative people in America by the AARP magazine. Frank's groundbreaking work has been widely featured in the media. Frank has served as a consultant to several healthcare organizations, NGOs, and foundations, including Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Fetzer Institute, and others. Frank is also the author of Being a Compassionate Companion audio series. Frank has been a keynote speaker and consultant for hundreds of educational, healthcare, spiritual institutions and programs. Welcome, Frank.
Thank you. Lovely to be with you. Thank you for organizing this. You know, I just want to say at the beginning how grateful I am for the Awaken program and for service space in general, and the your sister sites, the Daily Good and Karma Tube and the others. It's just a remarkable service that you offer the world, and I'm always tuning into them and always reading the summaries that I get, and I just think the world of it. And it's a great example of mutual beneficial service. Yeah, so thank you for doing it.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you. And definitely Pavi and the entire team, they are bringing amazing value to this world. But I would like to start with a question for you, Frank. You are a brave man. Day in and day out, you deal with death and the dying. You have brought dignity and beauty to the last moments of more than 1,000 people. And most of us shy away from the slightest discussion about death. What led you on this journey?
Oh, boy, Emmanuel, I think it's difficult to say. You know, our lives, at least my life, doesn't progress in a linear fashion, you know. It meanders a bit. There's a beautiful story that I share in my book about children going from village to village in India, and the paths were always meandering. You know, they'd go around a rock or over to a beautiful view, etc. And then they got sandals, and they started carrying heavy loads, and the paths became very straight and narrow. I think I walked barefoot for a long time, you know. I had an early relationship with death. My mother died when I was a teenager, and my father just a few years later. And so death and I were companions quite early on. I worked for a while in refugee camps in Central America and Southern Mexico, where I saw a lot of horrible dying, and that had a huge influence on me. And when I came back to the States, there the AIDS epidemic had exploded. And so we were just beginning, and we didn't know what we were dealing with. And so I had a lot of friends and colleagues who were dying, and we just jumped in to try and take care of people. And I think also, honestly, you know, when I was younger, I had a lot of pain in my life, a lot of suffering in my life. And I tried everything possible to avoid it. Everything. But at some juncture, and none of it worked, really. So at some juncture, you have to turn toward the experience, toward what hurts. And that's where the compassion is found, right? And so for me, meditation practice was a huge part of that turning toward the experience. It helped me to have the stability to go toward what I always wanted to run away from. So I would say that Buddhist practice, in its emphasis, actually, on the study of death has been an enormous influence on my life and a big factor in the work that I've done. We started the Zen Hospice back in the mid-80s, and we didn't really know what we were doing. It was a kind of fusion of spiritual insight and practical social action, you know. I thought there was a natural match between people who were cultivating what I might call the listening mind in meditation practice, or the listening heart, and people who really needed to be heard at least once in their life, folks who were dying. And in the beginning, that was mostly folks who were living in the streets of San Francisco. And so they didn't care much about Buddhism, you know. They just wanted honest relationship. And so if we were going to be of any service to them, we had to really see our own relationship to these issues, the sickness, the aging, the death, so that we could be of a really true companion to people. So that's a long answer to a short question, but gives you a sense of my work.
No, that is a beautiful journey, and it is also a very brave journey, as I believe, because it not everyone turns towards their suffering, and people usually walk away from it. But you've chosen to do it, and that has made the difference for you and for thousands of the lives that you've influenced with your work. And I want to congratulate you on your recent book, The Five Invitations, Discovering What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. And your book has been gathering rave reviews, so fantastic, congratulations. And these five invitations that you write in your book, welcome everything, push away nothing, bring your whole self to the experience, don't wait, find a place of rest in the middle of things, and cultivate a don't know mind. These are incredibly powerful life practices. So I'm curious, what led you to write this book, and how did you settle on these five invitations?
Yeah, well, I have to really give credit for the book, all the credit for the book, to my dear bride, my wife. Vanda, whose idea it was to write the book. She really wanted me to do this and thought that I had something useful to offer the world. And so as an anniversary present, she gave me the services of a wonderful editor, Maymay Fox, who helped me develop a proposal for it, and then we worked together on the book. So really I have to give my wife all the credit. The five invitations, I wrote in an airplane 30,000 feet over Kansas. I was invited by Bill Moyers, the well-renowned journalist, to come back to Princeton to help orient and teach his staff who were preparing for a film, television series called On Our Own Terms. And so I prepared this very salient talk, you know, to give at this conference. But on the airplane, I was thinking about what are the things that people who are dying had taught me. And on a cocktail napkin, I wrote down these five phrases that you just relayed. And I sort of stuck it in my shirt pocket. And when we came to the event that Bill had organized, I was on a panel with some renowned experts, and they were terrific and had a lot of things to say, but they ate up all the time. And I never got to give my salient Buddhist talk, you know. And so Bill pulled me aside and said, Frank, could you just speak by yourself for just a few minutes about the heart of the work? And so I pulled out my cocktail napkin, yeah. And on it I had written down, don't wait. Welcome everything, push away nothing. Bring your whole self to the experience. Find a place of rest in the middle of things and cultivate don't know mind. And I really have to give the people that I work with, the patients that I serve, the folks who were dying, who allowed me the great honor of being with them for teaching me these things. They all came from them. They were it was my way of phrasing it, but they were my teachers. And so it's what they most, it's their greatest gift to me, really. And so I felt the responsibility to share it with a larger audience of folks.
That's beautiful, and we are so glad you did. And I was hoping that in this call you could guide us through those five invitations. Your first invitation is welcome everything, push away nothing.
Well, actually, in the book it's a little different. It's don't wait, but we can go, let's go in whatever order you want to go in.
Okay. So I was thinking about welcome everything, push away nothing, that just because that is challenging me personally in a lot of ways. When you say welcome everything and push away nothing, that includes the good and the bad, and that involves a certain level of equanimity. And I'm curious, what does it really mean to welcome everything, especially in the reality of dealing with the death of a loved one, and how can we cultivate this attitude?
Well, you know, I think the most important thing to understand about this invitation is that the word welcome actually challenges our notion, our judgments about what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. Welcome everything, push away nothing, doesn't mean that you have to agree or that you have to like what's coming. It means you have to be willing to meet it. It's at your doorstep, and are you willing to meet it? You know? The great African-American writer James Baldwin wrote something beautiful when he said, you know, there are many things in life we must face that we cannot change, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. Yeah? So to welcome everything means to be willing to meet it, to be willing to open to the experience. And when we have that capacity, then we actually have more options. You know, we can see more of the picture. We can, we're not held in the stranglehold of that thing that we're resisting. Now, it's of course incredibly difficult when someone we love is dying. Maybe the most difficult thing to do, save perhaps our own death, but for some even it's more difficult. So how do we come toward this? Not in some kind of Pollyanna way, not in some kind of, it's all beautiful, because it's not. You know, death is difficult. It's messy, and it's, you know, painful sometimes, and it's, you know, challenging in so many ways. And it also can be transformative and mysterious. But most of all, it's normal. It's ordinary. All of us will go through this at some juncture. And so when we learn to turn toward the experience, we turn toward also what it has to offer us, what it has to teach us. You know, when we know that life is absolutely precarious, Emmanuel, you know, it's so precarious. when we touch that, when we let that in, when we let that seep into our bones, then we understand just how precious it is. And then we don't want to waste a moment. You know, we want to jump into our life with both feet. We want to tell the people that we love them. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So it's the precariousness of life that shows us what's really important, what really matters. Yeah? So to welcome is to include. Yeah? It's to be real and say, oh, this is part of life. This is part of life. Yeah? Now, it's here. What can I do with it? What can I learn from it? How can it help me to love more?
Wow. Wow. That is deep. I would believe that it is a difficult thing to be in touch with on an everyday basis. Do you have any cheat sheets for that?
say that last part again. I'm sorry.
No, I'm curious. I mean, it is such a difficult attitude to cultivate. And I'm wondering if you have any cheat sheets for us, any shortcut.
well, you know, a friend of mine was talking to me about my book the other day, and he said, you know, it's going to be a slow burn, this book. In other words, it's going to develop its audience slowly because people are going to have to work at it. You know, I think one of the things that we get caught in is imagining that, you know, there's a quick fix for just about everything. You know, these are the big, challenging issues of our life, right? And there aren't simple answers for all of them. But I think what's important to recognize is that all of us, each one of us, you and I, and everybody on this call, has the capacity to meet the suffering of another individual, to embrace it as their own, that we have within us the innate wisdom and compassion and love, which we need to address these kinds of, you know, really challenging issues. You know, some years ago, when I was a teenager, I was a lifeguard in a school for severely disabled kids. And when they went from kindergarten to seniors in high school. And I used to teach swimming in the pool, and these were very disabled kids. And there was one girl, Jasmine, this beautiful 16-year-old, who would have been the homecoming queen of her school, except that she had spina bifida. And the way the disease contorted her body, she was too self-conscious to get into a bathing suit and come into the pool. But she loved to watch, and she loved to make wisecracks, and she loved to flirt, you know, with the lifeguard. So I would come to she would come to the pool every few days, and I spent months really sort of trying to encourage her to give swimming a try, you know. And so I would playfully reflect back to her strength and her courage and her sense of adventure and the beauty that I saw radiating from within her, you know. You know, when someone believes that they are beyond love, you can't convince them to love themselves. But you can show them that they're loved, you know. The poet Galway Kinnell has a beautiful poem, St. Francis on the Sow, and he says, sometimes it's necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, you know. And so one day Jasmine came into the pool, and she took off her orthopedic shoes and braces, and she slipped her feet up onto the marble slab on the side of the pool and dipped her toes in the water, you know. And 6 months later, you know, she showed up one day in this turquoise bathing suit, I remember. And without any prompting, you know, she moved her body onto this marble slab, called me over, and leapt into my arms like a 7-year-old. You know, it was just beautiful to see. But here's the thing that's really important for me about this story. I mentioned earlier that I had a difficult upbringing as a child. There was a lot of suffering in my life. And like all children, I always held out the hope that someday someone would rescue me. And I imagined that I would be saved by love coming toward me. But it was just the opposite. I was rescued when love came through me. I discovered love through acts of kindness offered to me. Not offered to me, rather, but coming from me. Yeah?
Wow.
The experience of being with Jasmine and these other disabled kids, that unlocked a kind of compassion that was deep in the heart of my suffering. I discovered a love that was essential and reliable and undamaged, really, despite the difficulties of my family life. And so love has been my mentor all along, you know. It's what has enabled me to do this work for 30, 35 years now without ever burning out, yeah? Because I know the source of my actions is love and compassion. Yeah? And it's not something I manufacture. It's something I make contact with that's already here. Yeah. And each of us has that. Each of us have those qualities.
That is so, so powerful. It kind of reminds me of what I read once. I think it's attributed to Mother Teresa, that we are pencils in the hands of God. And the fact that you allowed love to flow through you instead of to you, I think it is, it's such a powerful lesson. And thank you for sharing that.
Yes, of course. Of course.
So you, another invitation that you have in your book is to bring your whole self to the experience. And this is something, again, I struggle with. How is it possible to live fully when we know that everything is impermanent, the clock is ticking away? It kind of seems counterintuitive. What are your thoughts on that, Frank?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that, you know, we like security. We like familiarity. We like the known. But what we're given is actually uncertainty. You know, we're given constant change. I mean, where is this morning's breakfast? You know, where is last night's lovemaking? You know, where, by God, has my blonde hair gone to? You know, I used to have it. Now I'm old and gray. Everything is changing all the time. It's always coming and going, right? That's in the very fabric of existence. And so to deny that truth is to suffer. To deny that, the reality of that is to cause yourself a lot of pain. So instead, what would happen if we turned toward this experience? Yeah? What would happen? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that we rely on impermanence. And then, well, I think we really rely on it. You know, that really boring dinner party that you're going to go to tonight, you know, it's going to end. You know, and you know, great dictatorships will fall, you know, and be replaced by thriving democracies. You know, you know, George Harrison, the great, you know, singer, reminded us that all things must pass. You know, and I think that to live in harmony, in attunement, if you will, with this basic truth helps us. You know, when we start to realize that our nature and the nature of the world is not fundamentally different, then the fact that things are constantly changing and are not fixed, this becomes a liberating opportunity rather than a threat. Yeah. So without impermanence, without constant change, your children wouldn't grow up. You know, pain would not go away. You know, our problems would never be resolved. So we need it. We actually need it. You know, I used to, many years ago, when my son was very young, he was 4 or 5 years old, he's a grown man now, I had a preschool with a friend of mine, and we used to take the children, 4 or 5 year olds, out into the woods to find dead stuff. Yeah, that was the object, that was the lesson of the day. And they'd pick up an rusty old car part or you know, a dead leaf or a twig or some bones perhaps from a dead animal. And we'd gather them up and we'd put them out on a blue tarp and we'd have a kind of show and tell. And the children were so curious about this. They weren't afraid at all, you know. They weren't at all afraid of death. They were curious about it. And they had great stories, you know, about how this piece of bark was a bed for a mouse and this rusty old car part was actually a part of a spaceship that had fallen down from the sky as it passed overhead. This one little girl said to me, "I think the leaves that fall from the trees are so generous to make room for the new leaves." Yeah. Isn't that beautiful?
That's amazing.
Yeah. And so, you know, I wish as adults we could recognize that, you know. We could recognize that, you know, everything's changing in the world, right? Seasons come and go. We all have birthdays. Governments come and go. But we like to think that we're the only solid thing. You know, we're the only thing. Everything's changing except me, right? We're the only solid thing in an ever-changing world. Well, no. When we do that, we pull ourselves out of the stream of change and we isolate ourselves and we become frightened. And when we recognize that we're in the stream with everybody else, we're in the boat with everybody else, then I think we're kinder to one another. I think it engenders a certain kind of letting go, relinquishing, a willingness not to take ourselves and our ideas so seriously. Yeah. So I think there's a great benefit to this in living a happier life.
Mm. not to take ourselves too seriously. I think that is a lesson that we can all subscribe to.
Don't you think? I mean, I do. I certainly get caught in that. I start thinking my views and opinions are, you know, the most important thing, and I have to defend them and prop them up, or my sense of self, my idea of Frank, you know. So, you know, in meditation practice, one of the tools that is sometimes used in certain practices is to label your experience, to name a particular kind of thought, for example, as judging or comparing, etc. My favorite label that I use all the time is creating a sense of Frank. Yeah, creating a sense of Frank, because that's what I'm doing a lot of times when I'm kind of propping up this identity that is subject to constant change. I'm always trying to make it something solid and fixed. Yeah, and it isn't.
That is awesome. And the third invitation that I wanted to come to, don't wait. It's a simple yet profound invitation. Can you share your insights on this, Frank?
Yeah, don't wait. Don't wait, you know. I mean, to imagine, first of all, at the time of our dying, that we will have the physical strength, the emotional stability, the mental clarity to do the work of a lifetime is a ridiculous gamble, yeah? So we ought not wait until the time of our dying to learn the lessons that it has to teach, right? As we've just been talking about, when we embrace the truth that inevitably all things must end, it encourages us not to wait in order to begin living each moment in a manner that's deeply engaged. And so we stop wasting our lives on meaningless activities. We learn to, as I say, hold our ideas and our identities a little less tightly. And instead of pinning our hopes on some better future, we focus on the present. And we're grateful for what we have right in front of us. And we say, I love you more often because we realize the importance of human connection. And we become more kind and compassionate, more forgiving of each other and of ourselves. I think don't wait is a pathway to fulfillment, actually, and an antidote to regret, you know. And by don't wait, I don't mean to suggest it's about, you know, getting all the toys. That's a mistaken notion, you know. Don't wait means, first of all, don't imagine you have limitless time. And don't wait to go toward what you love most. Yeah? I mean, mostly we imagine death will come later. No sense worrying about it now, yeah? Later gives us this comfortable illusion of safe distance, you know? But constant change and permanence is not later, it's now. Change is the norm, yeah? So don't wait is a kind of invitation to really step into our life with both feet, you know, both feet.
Mm-hmm.
Live fully. Live now. And by that, I don't mean that we should forget about the past or not learn from it or that we don't, you know, try and make plans for the future. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just suggesting that we hold those plans for the future lightly. Yeah.
That's absolutely powerful, Frank. Before we go to the next two invitations, I wanted to kind of reflect on a question that is burning not only in my mind, but I was looking at the Awaken Call chat page, and one of the things that is coming up is, how do you deal with death and dying? And I think this is more relevant for people who have just been through the process or who are caregivers for their own sick. How can they avoid compassion fatigue? And how can we find spaces for self-compassion?
Well, that's a big, big question, you know. And I have to begin by saying that I think compassion fatigue may be a misnomer. That often what people are calling compassion fatigue is a kind of empathetic overload, where they get so entangled in the suffering of another or of the world that they can't separate themselves out. You know, they feel with the other person or with the situation that they're encountering. And they get entangled in a certain way, in a way that's not too healthy. Compassion is something a little bit different than that. If empathy is I feel with, compassion is I feel for. So I can sit here in my own seat. I can have an empathetic relationship with you. and the suffering that you've experienced. But I also can have access to my own wisdom and skillfulness, and so I can be of some real support in actually eliminating or reducing at least the suffering in your life. So that's the distinction between those two that we need to make. But the other is to realize, at least from the vantage point that I work with, Emmanuel, I come from a Buddhist tradition. And in that tradition, there are all kinds of treatises on the subject of compassion. But I tend to boil it down to two things. I think of what we might call universal compassion and everyday compassion. Now, universal compassion is big and boundless and vast, and it's always been there. And everybody, you and me and everyone else, has always been embraced by it, even if we didn't know it. Yeah? That's universal compassion, boundless, the limitless quality of love. And then there's everyday compassion. That's when we do stuff. You know, we feed someone on the street, or we change soiled linens in a hospice, or we stand up against against injustice. These are actions of everyday compassion. But what starts to happen in that is we get tired. You know, we want people to start saying thank you for our good works. You know, for our volunteer effort. You know, and we start to feel exhausted. So that everyday compassion has to be grounded in what we could call universal compassion, right? It has to understand the source of that everyday compassion. But now universal compassion, as we just described it, big and boundless, it's beautiful, but it's without everyday compassion, without action, it's just a big idea. It's a big prayer, and if prayers were enough to solve the suffering of the world, we would have solved them a long time ago. Mm-hmm. So it needs, universal compassion needs you and I. It needs everybody on this call. It needs our arms and legs. It needs our eyes and tongues so that it can express itself in the world. Yeah? That's how it manifests. I have a friend of mine, Bernie Glassman. I just saw him on video conference the other night. He's a brilliant Zen teacher and famous for doing what he called plunges into the most difficult circumstances. I helped him to lead a retreat at Auschwitz many years ago. Really powerful. But anyway, he was teaching in Germany a few years ago, and he was talking about the Buddhist deity, we could call her, of Avalokiteshvara. She's the deity of compassion. And she has 1,000 arms. And in each hand, depending on the depiction, there can be an ear or a eye to see the suffering of the world or to hear the cries of the world. And 1,000 arms to respond. And so Bernie was talking about this, and a man raised his hand. He said, "That's all well and good, but I only have 2 arms. What should I do?" And Bernie said, "Well, I'm sorry, but you're mistaken." And the man looked down at his body, and he said, "No, I'm quite certain I have just 2 arms." And then Bernie did a beautiful thing. He had all the people in the room, and there were more than 500 people in the room, raise both their arms. Yeah? And there it was, 1,000 arms in the room. Do you understand? We're always imagining we have to do it all by ourselves, and we can't do it by ourselves. We need 1,000 arms. We need each other. That's what's so beautiful about, you know, what's happening here today on this call, what Service Space does all the time. The kinds of beautiful stories you carry us, those are 1,000 arms. So everyday compassion is grounded in universal compassion, and universal compassion needs our arms and legs to do the work, do its work in the world, yeah? And so we don't have to make this up, you know? We don't have to invent this. It's already here. And what we need to do is turn our attention toward it, you know? And let our broken hearts be filled with this compassion. And then naturally, it overflows, and we take care of others.
No, that's so absolutely awesome. And it kind of helps me realize the power of this community and the intentions in which this community is built as well. So, refocusing our attention to the universal compassion that is all around us and being a part of building it, I think that is amazing.
Yeah.
So the other intention, one of the other 5 intentions that you write about, is to find a place of rest in the middle of things.
Yeah.
And yet we live in a very restless world. How can we find rest in the middle of things?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right. You know, we have an awful lot of encouragement to go, 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 to the busiest person is the most, you know, effective person, etc. And we exhaust ourselves in this process. I also think that we imagine that we'll find rest by managing the conditions of our life. Like, we'll get rest when we go on vacation, you know, or when our list gets checked off, our email box is empty. But my email box has never been empty ever since I had one, and my list is never checked off. And so if I wait for that, I'm in trouble, you know. I have to learn to find rest right in the middle of what I'm doing. And I think we do that by bringing our attention fully and completely to whatever it is that we're engaged in, you know. Do we have time for another story?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so there was a woman at the hospice. Her name was Adele, and she was a cranky, grumpy, wonderful 86-year-old Russian Jewish lady. I just loved her. She was a no-nonsense woman, tenacious. And the night she was dying, they called me, and I came into the hospice. It was about 3 in the morning, and she was sitting on the edge of her bed in her, you know, hospital gown, her dressing gown, and a very good home health aide was sitting next to her. And I went in and I sat in the corner because that's my habit, to sort of see, is anything needed before I jump in to help, you know? And I saw that she was breathing with great difficulty. Every in-breath a struggle, every out-breath a struggle, you know? And this was despite the fact that we'd made all the right interventions. Well, the home health aide that was with her turned to her and she said, "Adele, you don't have to be frightened. We're right here with you." And Adele was this no-nonsense gal, you know, she turned toward her and she said, "Honey, if this was happening to you, you'd be frightened." Yeah. So I stayed in the corner, you know. But then, you know, a little while later, this very well-meaning home health aide turned to Adele and she said, "You look a little cold, but can I put a shawl on you? Would you like a blanket around your shoulders?" And Adele shot back, "Of course I'm cold. I'm almost dead." So now, I was watching this in the corner, and I saw two things, and maybe you even see them in the story. The first thing is, there was struggle. There was a labor to die, just as there's a labor to getting born. And in her case, the labor was with the breath. And the second thing was that she didn't want any nonsense. She didn't want to talk about tunnels of light or, you know, after-death experiences. She wanted something real and immediate and authentic. And so I pulled my chair up right in front of her, you know, and I knew her for a few months, so I could be very honest with her. And I looked her in the eye and I said, "Adele, would you like to struggle a little less?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Okay." I said, "I noticed something there. I said, I have difficulty breathing. I wonder what it would be like if you could put your attention on that little gap, that little pause between the exhale and the next." Now remember, this is a Russian Jewish lady, you know, 86 years old. She doesn't care about beans. Highly motivated in this moment to be free of suffering. So she said, "Okay." I said, "Okay, good, I'll do it with you." I didn't lead her, I didn't guide her. Just when she would breathe in, I would breathe in. And when she would breathe out, I would breathe out. And we did this together for a while, just like that. Just companioning each other, really. Not guiding her. I trusted that she knew what to do. And I noticed that as she put her attention there on that pause, that little gap, that stimulus and response, you know, between the exhale and the inhale, I noticed that the fear in her face just drained away, and she began to relax. And then, a little while later, she leaned, you know, went back onto her pillow, laid down in bed, and said, "I'm just going to rest now." And a little while later, she died very peacefully. You see, I think what happened is that Adele found a place of rest in the middle of things. See, all the conditions were the same. She was still dying. There was still difficulty or struggle with the breath, you know, all of those conditions were still there, but she found a new relationship. She found the place of rest right in the middle of the chaos. And I think we can do that in our lives. But I think that, you know, we've been so acculturated to try and change the conditions that we never think about how we can be in those conditions. You know, I worked with a man who was the head of a very large tech company, Silicon Valley. He was very troubled. He had all kinds of difficulties, stress difficulties, etc. And when I asked him what he did during his day, he said mostly he would sit in a room, a kind of board room, and people would come in, different departments, and give him reports, and he would comment on them. And I said, well, when do you pee? And he said, well, I'm very good. I don't have to do that so much. And I said, well, we're going to make a new rule. You have to pee every hour. And so it was just to get him all out of the boardroom and get him into the bathroom. And he went into the stall, where he would sit quietly for a few moments, even if he didn't have to pee. And we did this. We worked with this for a while, over a period of weeks with him. And the meditation stall became his meditation hut. The bathroom stall became his meditation hut. And he would go there and kind of re-find a place and stability. And then he would come back to his meetings. And after a while, he could just do that in the midst of his meetings. So how can we find a place of rest right where we are, right where we are, just in the middle of the chaos of our life? I think it's a great, great tool if we cultivate that capacity.
I totally agree, and I think this idea of a bathroom break for mindfulness, I'm going to promote that to everybody. Right?
There you go. There you go. There's a quick fix right there. And by the way, we worked on, after we, really mastered the meditation in the bathroom stall, we worked on walking slowly to the bathroom. Walking slowly to the bathroom, doing a little walking meditation on the way. We're being playful here, but, it is amazing how we drive ourselves so hard, so much of our exhaustion is not about doing too much. It's about doing it with an absence of wholeheartedness. I talk to doctors and nurses all the time, and, they're trained. They were, particularly doctors, were trained in their training to override their bodily, urges. They're trained to go without sleep for 48 hours, 72 hours sometimes. And, when you think about it, there's this kind of investment in being exhausted in our culture. When we tell people, how are you doing? Oh, I'm so busy, right? That's usually our answer. And what do we want from that? We want people to admire us for our busyness or to pity us for our exhaustion, or to imagine that we're really dedicated to what we do because we're exhausted. I think that's a sign of imbalance, not of maturity.
Totally. And speaking of culture, and I think this is a question that, again, pops up for me, is there is so much of divisiveness and hurt in our current political climate. And I'm curious how the awareness and acceptance of our own impermanence and the lessons from the death and the dying, how can it help us with understanding and dealing with the divisiveness and hurt that we see? In fact, for me, I'm even afraid to look at the news every day. I just don't want to see it anymore because it's so difficult. How do you deal with it?
Again, I think we have to really honor how difficult it is. We have to really recognize that. We can't just try and find some quick fix to that. The world is suffering now. Last night I went to see Al Gore's new movie about, climate change, and it was just really hard to watch. It was very difficult to watch, not only the difficulty of what's happening with our climate, but also how many setbacks we've had, how difficult it is to stay engaged when there's so many forces trying to push us in a different direction. So we have to honor the pain. I think that's really important. My own sense is that when we recognize the precariousness of life that we spoke about, that death comes to all of us, I think we understand that we're in the boat together, And this helps us to see that death and grieving and loss and constant change is our common ground, And that fear is also one of our common grounds. And we begin to recognize that in each other and move more kindly toward that fear. I think that's one of the things that can happen for us. Death comes to prince and pauper, right? It's the great clarifier. It shows us what's really important, right? Mm-hmm. And so a reflection on death is not morbid. It's not depressing. It's life-affirming. It shows us what matters most. Yeah. So I think that the reflection on death, the willingness to contemplate it, it's not just about preparing for some moment at the end of a long road. It shows us how to live our life right here, right now, you know. So I agree with you. It's difficult to read the newspapers. I think it's a compassion practice to read the newspaper, to read, you know, about the suffering of our world. But also, you know, I had a student recently who said, I've stopped reading the newspapers. It's too difficult. I said, no, you must read them. You must read them. First, you need to stay informed about the suffering of the world. But second, you need to see the good actions that are happening in the world. You know, like one of the most terrible things that I can imagine are school shootings. And so I tracked them for a while. I read about them all. I looked at all the school shootings over the course of a period of about a year. And I saw these horrible stories, but I also saw some beautiful stories, like a beautiful woman up in Oregon, a teacher by the name of Reagan, and she was a gym teacher, phys ed teacher, and a kid came to school with a gun one day, a handgun, and he shot three times. He shot one girl in the leg, I think, and another bullet ricocheted off and hit another student, and the other one fortunately didn't hit anyone. And this wonderful teacher with great kind heart walked right up to this boy with the guns, not in a confrontational way, but in a caring way. And she was able to, he turned over his gun to her, and she held him. She held him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they both cried together. Now, what this boy did was wrong. It's not, we're not justifying his actions. But what this teacher did was extraordinary. And not only did she hold him and stop greater violence from happening, but she made him a promise. She said, I will go with you everywhere. And so she went with him, Emmanuel, to the police station where he was booked, where he went into a jail cell. She went to his court cases and stayed with him to show him that he was companion, that he meant something to somebody. Yeah? I thought this was a remarkable expression of compassion in the world, you know. Just absolutely beautiful. And if I had not been reading about all the difficulties and all the suffering of those other cases, I wouldn't have seen this. And so, you know, compassion is the willingness to turn towards suffering. Sometimes we can eliminate that suffering, but sometimes what compassion does is give us the capacity to simply be with the suffering, to stay in the room when the going gets rough, you know, when we're in the land of unanswerable questions. Yeah. And so I think compassion is an innate quality in us that's a kind of guidance that is particular to the encounter with suffering. We have other kinds of guidance in us, but compassion arises to show us how to wisely move in the territory of suffering. And without that, we cannot make wise decisions in life, you know. We cannot, you know. Wisdom and compassion, they're two sides of the same coin. You know, wisdom without compassion is kind of heady and conceptual, and compassion without wisdom is a bit mushy and sentimental. So we need the both of them. You know, they're the two wings that allow us to take flight, you know. And if we only have one, we tend to fly in circles. Okay.
Wow. Wisdom and compassion, that's powerful. I mean, I think a lot of us kind of get caught in that space between just following compassion or being wise, not finding the balance there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in many countries and many spiritual traditions, you have this namaste or gassho or bringing the hands together in prayer, right? And in the Buddhist tradition, one way we think about that is when you bring your right hand, your left hand into a prayer position, that's a coming together of wisdom and compassion. It's a recognition of inseparability of not only the two of them, but of all of us, you know. Each of us are uniquely different, differentiated, you know, have entirely, you know, unique lives. And yet we're not fundamentally separate. We're come of the same cloth. And when we recognize that, we can appreciate our diversity without needing to separate, you know, in order to have that.
That is beautiful, Frank. Thank you. And I know we have a lot of questions from our viewers, but before we move it on to them, I have one question for you, which is the final invitation, the fifth invitation, which is to cultivate a don't-know mind. What is a don't-know mind, and how do we cultivate it?
Yeah, well, I felt obliged to put something Zen-like in this list, you know, and so I used this phrase. You know, the cultivated don't know mind is not about cultivating ignorance. Ignorance is not don't know. Ignorance is we know something, but it's the wrong thing and we insist on it. It's a misperception of reality, and there's a lot of that happening in the world right now, a great deal of ignorance, yeah? So don't know mind represents something else entirely. It represents a mind that's not limited by agendas or rules or expectations. It's free to discover. It's a mind filled with curiosity and wonder, yeah? I mean, when we're filled up with our knowing, you know, when our minds are made up, it narrows our vision. You know, it obscures our ability to see the whole picture. And it limits our capacity to act. We only see what the knowing allows us to see. So a wise person is both compassionate and humble and knows what they don't know. So to cultivate a don't-know mind is not about cultivating ignorance. It's about cultivating a sense of receptivity, curiosity, discovery. Yeah? And this is what enables us to enter our life with fresh eyes, you know, to empty our minds, if we will, and open our hearts. Yeah? That's a don't-know mind.
And how do we cultivate it?
Well, I think we cultivate it by, a friend of mine, when I began to teach, a friend of mine gave me a really good mantra. And he said, you should learn this one. I said, well, what is it? And he said, I might be wrong. And so whenever I go to teach, I often say that phrase before I start, I might be wrong. Yeah? So it's to really cultivate a willingness to not, you know, imagine we have all the answers. That's the first thing, yeah? We're not throwing away our knowledge. It's there in the background, ready to use it, you know, to aid us when we need it. But we don't get, you know, fixed on our ideas. We let go of a little bit of control, yeah? So to cultivate a don't-know mind is to cultivate our sense of curiosity. Now, you know, let me give you an example. If there's a mountain lake that you love, right, that you want to go hiking to in the Sierras, let's say, here in California, well, you got to love the lake because it's a long hike up the mountain. It's a big deal to get up that mountain. But it's not enough to love the lake. You have to also love the walk up to the lake. Otherwise, when the mosquitoes come out, you'll turn back. Right? So love is the kind of fuel for the journey that gets you up the mountain and motivates you to go there along the way. But there's something else. I think if love is the fuel for the journey, joy is the spark that ignites the fuel. And one of the ways that I see joy in my life, at least, or and it's the way I cultivate this don't know mind, is as a kind of playfulness. You know, when you see children play, they don't play for a purpose. They just play to discover. They just play to have fun. You know, I have a 2-year-old granddaughter, and she's just all about discovery. And I love being with her because it challenges my view, you know, my way of seeing things. You know, it's not that I'm trying to become a 2-year-old, but I am trying to learn from her about what it's like to be playful, what it's like to have joy, you know? So can we take something that we think is absolutely horrible, and not in a Pollyanna way, make it nice? I don't mean that. I'm not trying to make a Hallmark card out of life. I mean really look and see, how could I see this from a new perspective? Yeah. And if I did, what might it have to teach me? Yeah. All right.
Awesome.
We'll stop there. I'm really curious to have a conversation with some of the listeners.
Yeah. No, this is beautiful. This is beautiful, Frank. Thank you so much. I just feel like I have tapped into a big river of wisdom, and it's and overwhelmed right now. So thank you for sharing all this. And I know there's a whole lot of questions waiting for you. We have a huge number of people attending this call, so I would love to open it out to them and have their wisdom and questions to you as well.
Beautiful. Let's try and keep let's ask the people who are calling in to boil down their question to the essence and what's most important so that we get to as many of them as possible, because I'd really like to speak to as many of your guests as we can.
Thank you so much, Frank, and thank you, Emmanuel. Just a reminder to our guests that if you have a question, press *6 and you'll be added to the queue. If you'd like to send it in online, you can write in to ask@servicespace.org. Frank, I wanted to read out one of the comments that came in, reflections that came in from one of our listeners, Laura Krell. It's a beautiful reflection for you. And she says, when my 28-year-old son died in a motorcycle accident just 3 weeks from moving home to finish his PhD, I learned what being sick to death actually means. Mm. I cried nonstop for weeks. On one of those occasions, I was outside in my garden. I couldn't take a deep breath and felt as if I was having a heart attack. In a flash, I felt something I can only describe as a crack in my chest. I could feel the earth breathe, moan, and sob with me. For a moment, I thought I had lost my mind, but it was very real. I could feel what all mothers who have lost a child feel, and I knew I was not alone in my suffering. Shortly after, I read a quote, "The heart that is open never breaks." In that instant, I believe my heart was split wide open. The loss of my son opened me to the suffering of all beings, and I felt a strange peace.
Oh, Laurel, thank you for that. That's just so beautiful. Wow. Yeah, I mean, I love what you said about our heart breaking open, you know. You know, when people, as you said in your introduction, I was the founder, co-founder of a program called the Zen Hospice Project, which was the first Buddhist hospice in America. And when people would come to volunteer there, one of the questions I would ask them is, are you willing to open your heart and have it be broken? Yeah? And because I think it's often in the broken heart, as Laura was describing, that we find what really helps, you know? And it's often communicated in the silence between people, yeah? So we have to let all these wise words that Frank's been saying or that Manuel's been saying, let them really drop into our hearts and feel them, you know, and let them guide our lives. It's the most beautiful and difficult thing to be a human being. Yeah, it's the most difficult thing.
Thank you, Frank. I'm going to jump in with a couple of questions here as well. And I wanted to ask, in the process of this work, I imagine that denial is something that comes up often, either in patients or in caregivers. And I was wondering how you see, what you see to be the role of denial.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I think that we have this, aggressive almost, aversive relationship to denial in our culture, you know. People are always trying to get others out of denial. and I'm like, don't take it away unless you've got something better to replace it with. You know, denial just, you know, first of all, at a certain stage of our experience, it's necessary. You know, it's a protective device in a way. It cushions us. It allows us to kind of assimilate, if you will, and metabolize some of what's experienced. It's too shocking for our system in a certain way. And so there's a usefulness to denial for a particular period of time. Now, denial that, you know, is promoted over a period of time just breeds ignorance and fear. You know, I can't be free if I'm rejecting any part of my experience, really. But, you know, when we're in shock, oh my. You know, a woman died in our hospice while her sister was down the hall in the bathroom. When the sister came back, I said, I'm sorry, your sister's passed while you were down the hall. And the woman said, well, she's not dead yet. Now, in a way, it was obvious. Her sister had died. But she wasn't ready for that truth yet. So I said, well, when was she most alive? That was my question, the first question to her. She said, oh, when she was a youngster, she was a, you know, spelunker, and she went into caves, and she was a great adventurer, you know. And then she ran this, you know, political magazine, and she was a firebrand, you know. And she kept going like that through the story of her sister's life. And until then she said, I remember, Frank, we went to the hospital last week, and the doctor said that she couldn't do any more chemo, and now she's here, and then she was getting weaker and weaker, and she stopped eating, remember? And she came to the current moment. Yeah. And then we talked about washing her body and taking care of her. So it wouldn't have been helpful for me to say, no, step out, you're in denial, you know, let's get real here. You know, she just wasn't ready yet. So she had to tell some of the story and get current really with the situation. Yeah. So denial is not the enemy. It's not the enemy. Yeah.
That is a really valuable reframing to have. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. It brings to mind one of the things that we talk about often at Service Space. And just, you know, a few years ago, Google famously announced its plans to, quote, unquote, solve death. And I was wondering how you look at some of the trends in our current societal relationship to death, and you know, where do you find the hope or the foothold in this momentum that seems rushing towards, I don't know, like this wish for the impossible eternity or eternal life?
Yeah, well, I think that I was speaking with a group of folks from Silicon Valley not long ago, and I said that death is inevitable, and one guy raised his hand. He said, "I'm not so sure about that," you know. And he said, "There's a lot of us in this room that are working on it." And I said, "Well, great, great." I said, "Okay, let's step back from this word death for a moment. Let's just begin to look at endings. Let's just look at endings of things. You know, you want to know what death has to teach? Look at endings. The ending of an exhale. The ending of a day. The ending of a meal. The ending of the sentence. You know, how do you meet endings in your life? Do you go unconscious around them? Or, like, for example, when you're at a gathering of friends, do you leave either emotionally or mentally before the event's over? You know, do you ghost out the door because you think no one noticed that you were there, so they won't notice that you've gone? Or are you the last one in the parking lot, you know, waving to all the participants who came to the conference, you know? Do you feel sad and teary-eyed with endings? Or are you anxious, you know, indifferent with them? You know, do you leave before the event's, you know, really finished? You know, do you leave in your mind and heart before the event's really finished? Yeah. Do you jump the gun, so to speak? Look at the way we meet endings. That's a really useful thing. Even if we extend life 200 years, 300 years, at some juncture, death will come. But in between all that, you know, death is not something that's happening at the end of a long road. It's in the marrow of every passing moment. So let's learn about our relationship to endings, yeah, and how the way we meet this moment, the ending of this moment, shapes in a way, or at least in part, the way the next one arrives. Yeah. So I think, look, since before the Greeks, people have always had a great wish for eternal life. Yeah. But I think eternity is not necessarily a long, long time. You know, St. Augustine, the great Christian mystic, he talked about the now as neither being in time nor out of time. The now is the moment of eternity. Now is not some millisecond, nanosecond between times. It's outside of time. Yeah. And we've all had that experience of timelessness. Yeah. We can have that here and now. Yeah.
There's another great reframing of death in terms of endings, and meeting it in those everyday, every moment ways, in a sense. I was thinking similarly, the word suffering, maybe we magnify it in our heads and then as a result kind of separate ourselves from it. Is there, how do you define that word?
Yeah, it's kind of a big word. We throw it around in the Buddhist world a lot, and I use it in my book, I know, a lot. And, you know, we think of suffering as something big that's happened to somebody else, you know, refugees fleeing Syria or children starving in a African country. But, you know, suffering is just our relationship, in a way, to life. You know, there's physical pain, for example, but then there's our relationship to that, yeah. You know, suffering is you buy an iPhone and then the next model gets announced, you know, next week, you know. or you fall in love with somebody and then they, you know, you get to know them better. You know, all these things are suffering, you know. The fact that, you know, your roof will leak is suffering. So it's our relationship to conditions, you know. This is a way to think about suffering, yeah. Ignorance is suffering. Ignorance is suffering. It's the biggest form of suffering, you know. So one of the ways I talk about this is that we have different kinds of relationships to life. And one way we have, one way that we suffer is we demand that life be different than it is. That's the first thing. We have a kind of demand, yeah. And it's this unquenchable thirst. that things be other than they are. And so whatever's here is not enough. And then there's the opposite of that, which is a kind of defense, an aversion to life as it is. You know, we don't like the way things are. And so, you know, we make an enemy out of everything and everyone, you know. And we stay in this perpetual cycle of suffering. And the third, of course, is what we just mentioned, which is ignorance or delusion, which is, you know, I don't really see the way life is. I don't see reality as it is. And so I keep tripping and falling into the same hole, you know. So it's one of the ways I think about how we perpetuate the suffering is through a kind of demand of life, a defense against life, and a delusion or fantasy about how life is.
It's amazing listening to you talking about the work that you've done in a very specific realm of, you know, of life. It feels like it applies to almost every dimension. And, you know, I'm sure the book Five Invitations has reached all kinds of diverse audiences. Have you been surprised by any of the unexpected corners that have been receptive?
Well, again, I have to really give credit to my wife, to Vanda, because she's the one who really saw that. You know, she saw that there was a whole audience of people out there that could really benefit from the wisdom that we learn at the bedside of people who are dying that's applicable to the rest of our lives, has a relevance for the rest of us in so many domains of our lives. Yeah. So, yeah, absolutely. I gave a talk at a thing called The Long Now, which is a very beautiful program that happens here in San Francisco, created by Stuart Brand, the futurist. And it's normally a program for people who think in terms of trends, 10,000-year trends. Yeah? And the audience for it is usually people who come on their laptops and, you know, iPads. And it's a very heady crowd, and about 700 people at the Jazz Center in San Francisco. And I spoke, as I'm speaking now, with you. It was really interesting. Everyone closed their laptops and put away their iPads. And they were riveted, not because they didn't know me from a hole in the wall. It was just the subject was so galvanizing, you know. It's like it cuts through. Death cuts through, right? All of our, you know, pretensions. And, again, shows us what really matters. So, yes, and we don't have to wait until the time of our dying to learn the lessons we have to teach. I mean, that's why I wrote the book. It's not about how do you take care of dying people. It's about what do you learn from dying that can help you live a life of more meaning and integrity, happier life.
Wonderful. I have a bunch more questions, and I'm going to go to the caller in our queue.
Yeah, let's do that.
Hi, this is Kozo from Cupertino, and thank you so much for this call and the five invitations, Frank. I wanted to ask you a question about one of the invitations of welcoming everything and resisting nothing. But from a different point of view, I know you're a lot of that's dealing with people who are dealing with people who are dying and welcoming, you know, whatever's happening in that moment. I'm wondering if you have ever seen it the other way around, where people who are dying or people you could call it a death wish, where they're resisting, you could call it the brokenness of life, and they're almost like giving up, you know? And I think about, you know, some stories I've heard of a married person whose spouse dies, and within 5 months, they're dead as well, you know, even though they were perfectly healthy before the spouse died. And I'm wondering if you've experienced that, or if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, beautiful question, Kozo. Thank you for bringing it up. And I think that this last part that you just mentioned, you know, a spouse dying after his or her spouse has maybe died of a long-term illness is a really common phenomenon. We see that quite a lot. You know, partly it's also a result of the fact that they've usually worked really hard in taking care of them, oftentimes sacrificing their own health in that process, in part because the healthcare system didn't provide or wasn't able to provide enough support for that individual. So there are multiple factors that lead into that outcome. Mm-hmm. And yes, we know that there are some people in life who, you know, see death as the best solution for their problems. Their life has become desperate and unlivable in many ways to them, and so they see death as, you know, the way to bring all of that suffering to some kind of closure. But I'm not so sure that we can promise people that, you know, that death will end all our suffering, you know. This is a story that we've told ourselves. There was a woman in our hospice, she was an old Italian lady, you know, and whenever you'd go into a room and ask her, how are you today, she'd say, oh, I just want to die. And it became kind of a running gag when I'm in hospice. And I said, oh, you're not taking her seriously. So I went to her, and she told me, I said, how are you today, Grace? And she said, oh, I just want to die. And I said, Grace, what makes you think that dying will be so good? You know, and it was a counterintuitive question to ask, you know. And she thought, what kind of a question is that to ask a, you know, 80-year-old Italian lady? But she said, well, at least I'd get out then. And I said, well, get out of what, Grace? And, you know, Grace was a devoted wife to her husband who was a truck driver. And every day she had laid out his clothes, paid all his bills, made him a meal every day. And now she was sick, and she couldn't imagine that he could take care of her, nor could her daughter. She was the giver. So she came to the hospice expecting she would die quickly. Well, I said to her, I think you should talk to your husband about it. I didn't facilitate it. They were married for 50 years. I figured they could work it out. All I know is that a few days later, Grace decided to move home. And she lived at home in the care of her husband for another 6 months, in the care of her daughter for another 6 months, and died quite comfortably. Yeah, it was just the best strategy she had, you know, to deal with what she felt were unworkable problems, unimaginable, unbearable problems. Yeah. And so I think that sometimes it's really useful to inquire with people, ask a counterintuitive question, to let people know how much we care about their presence, you know, and to really value the enormous healing power of human presence, yeah, which I sense you have a sense of, Kozo. Yeah. Mm.
Thank you for that. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Frank, I wanted to ask about, you know, I feel like the work that you do demands it kind of calls out all of the ways in which we might be bluffing to ourselves about how we're serving. And to serve at someone's deathbed requires a kind of authenticity, it seems like. And I'm wondering what, again, for those of us at Service Spaces, is a question we explore. What has serving in this way taught you about true service?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. Well, you know, I was overzealous in the beginning. I thought I knew everything, you know, and what was right for everyone else. You know, a few years ago, I had a heart attack when I was teaching a retreat for docs and nurses on compassion. And that was really a great teaching, you know. It was really humbling. And I really saw what it was like to be on the other side of the sheets, so to speak, and what a different view it is. So I think you know, one of the things that I learned in the course of my work is the value of humility. But the other was to see myself in the other person is really important. And I don't mean in some kind of psychological projection. I mean really to see my mother in this woman, Grace, that I was just speaking of, to see myself in her, you know. And when I do that, when I see them in me, it fundamentally shifts the way in which I serve. Yeah. For me, service has always been about mutual benefit. It's never the good guy riding on a white horse, you know, to save the poor unfortunate one. That's nonsense. That's just more separation. That just closes the heart. So to be of real true service is to recognize the mutuality of this experience. Yeah. For me, that's essential. You know, there was in Zen Center, there's a what they call a mountain seat ceremony. It's when the new abbot is installed, and students come forward and ask seemingly combative questions of the new abbot to test her capacity to lead the community with compassion and wisdom. And one student came to this abbot at this particular ceremony I was at, and she said, "Tell me, what does spiritual practice have to teach me about, you know, taking care of others?" And the abbot, in a very Zen way, shot back, "What others? Take care of yourself." And then the student said, "Well, how do I do that? How do I take care of myself?" And the abbot said, "Well, of course, serve other people." Yeah. In other words, really get it. Yeah. That, you know, we're in this boat together. Yeah. We just are.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to, that reminds me a little bit of the Dalai Lama's be selfish, be generous.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah. Yeah.
I have more questions, but I'm going to go to our caller here.
Great.
Hi, this is Elisa in Seattle. And first, I just want to thank you. This has been an absolutely amazing, like I don't know how to say it. Well, I'm 100% present, and it means so deeply to me what you've shared. And I have two questions. And the first question is, when you were speaking of endings, which I'm experiencing right now, a lot of, and you said you didn't use these words, but how you shape and deal with these endings and is how you can shape or treat the new beginnings. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could go into a little more of what you meant by that.
Well, what I was trying to get at is the way in which we end one experience shapes the way the next one begins. You know, if you think about, you know, you've just had an argument with your, you know, partner or your best friend, and then, you know, you have to step into, you know, some other situation. Well, the residual of that is, particularly that residual that's been unresolved, is there with you. You carry it into the next moment, yeah? So for me, for example, when I when I'm in a hospital, I move from one patient's room to the next patient's room. I have to really make sure I bring some honorable closure, if you will, to the exchange that I'm having with the patient in the room, even if that person's in a coma. You know, I have to do that, bring some closure to that. And then I have to consciously step into the next room. So I have this silly habit, Elisa, and maybe you can try it. When I go into a patient's room, I look and see where the hinges are on the door. Are they on the right or on the left? And if they're on the right, I step in with my right foot. Now, this could be considered, you know, a mindfulness practice or a compulsive disorder, right? Obsessive compulsive disorder. I choose to think of it as mindfulness. It's a way of me entering the room deliberately, mindfully, mm-hmm. recognizing I'm crossing a threshold into a new world. Yeah. So, mm-hmm. As much as possible, being willing to conclude an exchange, whether it's with myself or in another, before I move to the next one. Now, we can't always make it totally complete. So maybe we have to promise ourselves, you know, like, I'm going to come back to that later. I promise I'm going to explore that later. I'm angry now or I'm upset now, and I'm going to explore it later. And that's how we do it. You know, it's not compartmentalizing. It's a promise. I'm going to temporarily put this aside so that later I will come back to it and address it.
Okay. It's funny. I'm having to move, and I was thinking more, oh, how I leave where I'm moving and go to the next place. It just shifted the whole perspective of how I deal with this, which was fabulous. And the other, with what you're saying, with the right foot, left foot could also be in essences, like what maybe choosing something like openness instead of like just being open and having that perception.
Right.
I see that.
Right. Intention does matter. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes.
Go ahead.
The other question I had, oh, I'm sorry. I don't mean to talk over you. The other question I had was, it seemed what I'm hearing throughout all this is that there's this incredible, I don't know if it's a gift you have, of having somehow in your stories the right questions and actions come with skill. Some of a lot of it seems like you have this incredible skill from your experience. But in your stories, I was wondering if a lot of this comes from skill, or do you also think that sometimes it actually comes through you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good way to say it. That's a very good way to say it, Lisa. I think that, you know, when we're present, and present means, first of all, I'm here, I'm available, my mind is not, you know, scattered and, you know, lost in the future or the past, but I'm actually present. That's helpful. And when I'm present, I come into contact with something far more, a little different than that. It's what we could call presence. You know, presence is another way to think about that. It's the fullness of my being. Yeah, the fullness of my being. And it has a power. palpable quality to it. You know, most of us have had some experience like this, yeah? And then we sort of tune in a sense, to a kind of inner guidance, one way to say it. And that inner guidance isn't coming from some, you know, archangel somewhere, although that might be someone's belief system. In my case, it just feels like it's an innate human quality, an essential human quality, an essential quality of my being that rises up in response to the situation, as an appropriate response to the situation in which I'm meeting. As I said earlier, compassion arises in response to suffering, you know. Curiosity arises, you know, in me as a kind of guidance. Playfulness arises in me as a kind of guidance, you know. These are essential human qualities that we all have and that can really serve us, I think. Yeah. So, you know, the question or the challenge, of course, is to get quiet enough to be able to listen, to not be so filled up with our knowing that we don't actually tune in or listen to what it is that's emerging that might be of real benefit in the situation. So I sense that you're able to do that, you know, that you're just quiet yourself, calm yourself, and then say, okay, what might I intuitively know, you know, that wonderful sixth sense of intuition, yeah.
Frank, what comes up for me listening to you and thinking about the thousands or, you know, hundreds of thousands of stories and experiences that you've borne witness to, how do you work with all of this in such a way that it doesn't weigh you down, or it doesn't, you know, what is the honorable closure in each experience there or in your practice that allows you to not be paralyzed almost by the depth of suffering?
Yeah, well sometimes, you know, I am. Sometimes I just get lost. You know, and that's just very human. You know, we're going to get lost. We're going to get overwhelmed. We're going to get, you know, swept away by our sadness or grief. And, you know, I think just to recognize that, you know, that when I'm with somebody else who's suffering, for example, I'm looking at my own fear. I'm looking at my own grief all the time, you know. So it's not like I'm 100% over there with them. I'm actually keeping a percentage of my attention in my own experience. So that's the first thing. The second is that I have to do practices which help to keep me balanced. You know, in the midst of the AIDS epidemic, you know, sometimes I knew 20, 30 people who died in a week, you know, and there was enormous grief in my life. And so I would do three things. The first thing is I went back to my meditation cushion to stabilize, to assimilate, to metabolize this experience, to gain perspective. So meditation practice was essential for me. The second thing I did was I went to a body worker. And I went to this body worker once a week, and he was a really great guy. And I'd walk in his office, and I'd lay on his table, and he'd say, "Where should I touch today, Frank?" And I'd point to my shoulder. And he'd put his hand on my shoulder, and I would just weep for about an hour. I'd just cry for an hour. And then I'd get up from the table, and I'd say, "See you next week." He'd say, "Okay." We hardly ever had a conversation. It was just that I needed that relational touch to help me contact and feel free to express the sadness that was in my life. So that was one of the things I did. And the third thing I did was I used to go to a hospital where some friends of mine were nurses, and I went onto the maternity ward where there were babies who were born to addicted mothers, and these babies were needed to be held. And so before I would go home to my own children, I would go to this hospital, and I would hold these babies, and I would sit in a rocking chair, and these babies would shake so much, you know. And it was just helpless in certain moments to be with them. And then what would happen is if I just stayed there, you know, with a loving presence, they would calm down and they would be able to sleep. There was something about that tenderness, that ability to nurture and to calm those little babies that helped me enormously in working with the suffering that I couldn't do anything about, you know, that I was helpless in front of sometimes, and that I felt lost. So those practices, they were inevitable. They were essential to me in my work, you know, absolutely essential to keep some kind of balance, you know, and to stay human and not become, you know, a technician. And people are doing this all over the place, you know. It's, you know, God, we talk about the problems of healthcare, but my God, I wish I could share with you how thousands of stories that I have of nurses and home health aides and docs and social workers doing remarkable things way beyond the scope of their jobs, you know. There's a man I know in a big hospital, and he's a nurse's assistant, you know. He's got the grunt job. And after a code blue in a hospital where it's a mess, you know, he comes in and his job is to clean up the room, and the patient's still there. And he walks over to the patient, he leans over to her, and he said, "You've died now, and I'm going to, as respectfully as possible, wash away all dust and confusion." And then he bathes her body. This is beautiful. And this is happening all the time in the world. All the time. And we need to include it. We need to know that this kind of basic goodness is there in the world, and that we can have a basic trust in our humanity that won't let us down.
Frank, we're almost at the end of the call, but as you were speaking, I was just thinking back to, you know, you didn't give us too many details of your childhood, but we know losing your parents so young, we know that it was a very difficult, troubled time, and it's breathtaking to me what that troubled child has grown up to become and the space that he's holding in our world. We have many people in this community who work with at-risk youth, children who've been through and are going through all kinds of trauma. And I wonder if you have any words of guidance for them.
Yeah, you know, boy, you know, the complexity of trauma and the complexity of what sometimes our children, particularly children at risk, are living through these days is devastating. You know, it's mind-boggling that people can still be walking around, really. But I'll only tell what helped me, you know. Just love them. Love them until they can love themselves again. Yeah. That's what really helped me. People loved me. They showed me that it was possible, you know, to love myself. And so I borrowed their love. They loved me until I could love myself. And I think that's the most important thing here. Love them until they can love themselves again.
So many more questions. Just one more that I'll ask before the last one. Is this question about something that you mentioned about death, you know, that it's not a medical process, that the dying process does its own work, just like the birth process?
Yeah.
Can you just speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, you know, we treat, in this country, in many countries, we treat dying as if it was simply a medical event, and it's so much more than that, you know? It's so much more profound than that. And so, you know, there is no one single model, not the medical model or not religious models, that are large enough to embrace all that happens in the time of dying. And so we have to really bring the best of multiple models, if you will, to bear. You know, for me, dying is much more about relationship. It's about our relationship to those we love, to the suffering of the experience, to death itself, to God or whatever image of ultimate kindness we hold. And so the work of being with dying is about, you know, attending to those relationships. And, you know, and the first characteristic that we need in that relationship is mastery. We need to know what we're doing. You know, when I'm dying, I want a doctor or a nurse with me who can manage my pain and control my symptoms. I need that. But that won't be enough. I need somebody who's going to be comfortable in the territory of meaning, who will help me find out what the purpose and value of my life has been and of this experience. But then there comes a juncture in the dying process where meaning falls away. And we're in a different territory. Grandma's, you know, we're still asking Grandma about her favorite piece of music. And she's well past that now. She's turning in a different direction. She's turning toward the territory of mystery, the land of unanswerable questions, you know, where we're all explorers, where we're discovering together. Yeah? And that's the land where, you know, we don't have the answers. And the best thing we can do is stay present, bear witness, yeah? So mastery, meaning, and mystery. We need people comfortable in all those territories. We need people skillful in those territories to accompany us in through the dying process. Yeah, and then we let the dying process lead. We trust it. We know that there are certain conditions in the dying process that are conducive to helping us wake up to our life. It strips away all of the identities that we've been carrying, where they're gracefully given up, but they all go. And then we come down to something far more essential in our life, something much more fundamental, you know, true, real, that we can rely on. And, you know, that's much more than a medical event. And so dying shows us that. And it doesn't show us that just so we can have a good death. It shows us that so that we can have a full, rich life. Yeah? And again, hopefully we step into with our full hearts. Yeah.
What a profound reminder and an inspiration to close out our call on. We do have one final question, Frank, that we ask all of our guests, and that is, how can we, as the Extended Service Space Awaken Calls community, serve you in the invaluable work that you're doing?
Serve me?
Serve you or the spirit of your work, yes.
Yeah. I mean, look, as I said earlier, you know, dying is an ordinary experience in a certain way. It happens to all of us. None of us get out of here alive, right? So let's turn toward it. Let's sit down with it and have a cup of tea with it and get to know it really well, you know? Let's see what it has to show us about our lives. So that's the first thing that you could do, is turn toward this experience. When there's a friend or a family member that maybe is going through it or anticipating going through it, go toward them, you know? Sit down, learn from them. You know, there's museums where there are great paintings hanging, where we go and honor great artists. There ought to be such places in our communities where people come to die, where we come to them and we say, please tell us how to live. You know? So that's the first thing. You know, there's so many people living in nursing homes and skilled residential care facilities that are totally alone. Go to one. Sit next to somebody for a while. Stare out the window with them. You know, and me personally, you know, you were very kind to mention this book, The Five Invitations. You know, buy it. I know you could help me. And I don't mean for the money. I mean, buy it and read it. And share it with some friends, you know, get a group of people together to talk about it. You know, if you go to our website, thefiveinvitations.com, there's a thing there to how to do a book group and a series of questions that could really help people navigate that book, you know. So I think I wrote it as a gift. I wrote it to help people step more fully into their lives and you know, mutual benefit here, you know. Buy the book, that helps me, and I hope that it will help the people who read it as well.
Beautiful. And we will definitely send out the links to all the website and
great.
The other resources that you mentioned to all the people on this call. We are a few minutes over, but before I close with our minute of gratitude in silence, I wanted to say that it really felt like speaking with you. It wasn't just speaking with you. You know, I feel like the spirit of all the people that you've helped transition, all the care workers that you've worked with, your wife who prompted you to write the book and put its messages out in the world. Thank you for bringing them all into this conversation and enriching our lives through your generosity,
yes.
Frank.
They're my true teachers.
We will close this call with a minute of silent gratitude for all that we've received and in the hopes that gratefulness and what we've benefited from can be beamed out to places where that kindness and that love and that generosity can be of service. And at the end of that minute, I will unmute all our callers so that they can join me in a round of thank yous to you, Frank. A minute of silence. And now on the count of three, a thank you to Frank. One, two, three.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls.
To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.